The governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers round him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took him off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. This is the word of the Lord.
Morning, everyone. Today, we are continuing in our series entitled Big Questions. And today, we are asking one of the biggest questions of them all. What about suffering? Now, over the course of the last few weeks, I have read lots of articles on suffering. I've studied lots of commentaries on suffering, and I've listened to lots of sermons on suffering. And one of the sermons that I listened to this week was from a megachurch in Texas. Now, I confess, I'm not normally in the habit of listening to sermons from megachurches in Texas, but this one popped up, and it was being preached by a woman, so I thought that was quite an encouraging start. And she began by saying, "Brothers and sisters, today I'm going to be preaching about suffering." And there was silence. You could have heard a pin drop. And then, right at the back of this huge auditorium, someone gave a whoop. It's very American. And then someone else gave a whoop. And then a couple of people began to tentatively clap. And then a few more joined in, and soon there was a roar of applause, and people were cheering and stamping their feet and hollering, "Hallelujah!" I was really impressed. What a beautiful response to hearing that they're about to hear a talk on suffering. I then felt very sorry for them for the next half an hour because the sermon was rubbish. Platitudes and bunkum. But I wonder what your response is this morning. Maybe you saw on the weekly email that we're talking about suffering and you're still here, and that's very impressive. Well done. I wonder how you feel about it. I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it. On the one hand, it's a really important issue. Of course, many of us here today will be suffering in mind, body, or spirit. Or if we're not, someone who we love is. And even if that's not the case, we only have to turn on the news to see that suffering is rife across our world. So this is important because it's a personal issue which affects us all. It's also important because it's one of those really important questions that people want to ask when they're trying to work out if they believe in God or not. It's the kind of question that we've been asking a lot on the Alpha course over the last several weeks. I guess if you were to ask a load of people what's the main reason why they don't believe in God or why they struggle to believe in God, I suspect the most common answer would be because of suffering, because of evil. How does a loving God let suffering happen? So it's important personally and it's important philosophically. The trouble is, there are no easy answers. Right at the start, I want to encourage you to be deeply suspicious of anyone who offers you easy answers on these questions. I don't think there are. It's incredibly complex. And so I approach today tentatively, not claiming to have a whole load of answers. And frankly, this has been the hardest talk to prepare since I've been here at St. Luke's for 18 months. It's been a real struggle. And so I offer it to you today in humility This is where I've got to in my thinking, and I hope it might be helpful as you think about these things too. And I'm aware that for some of us today, this will be a sort of an intellectual issue, but for others of us, it will be very real and very personal right now. In his book, Where is God When It Hurts? Philip Yancey says, the experience of suffering prompts two questions. The question of cause and the question of response. And so today we're going to think about both of those things. So cause, well, why do we suffer? What causes suffering? And why on earth does God allow it? And then response, how do we respond? How do we find a way to survive suffering and maybe even to thrive? So firstly then, this cause, why? Why do we suffer? What causes suffering? Well, we haven't got time to go into loads of stuff here, but let's put it relatively simply, which is evil causes suffering in the main. Not always, but most evil leads to suffering in some way, shape, or form, and most suffering is caused directly or indirectly by evil. And we might want to split up evil, this is what philosophers and theologians often do, into moral evil, that is to say, evil which has been caused by human decisions, and natural evil, so things like viruses and volcanoes, earthquakes and floods. So this is often called the problem of evil. And the question really is something like, how is it possible for a God who is omniscient, that is to say, all-knowing, omnipotent, all-powerful, and benevolent, one of my favourite words, all-loving, to allow evil and suffering to exist? We might put it the other way around. We know that evil and suffering do exist. So how is it possible, therefore, that an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent God can exist? Because surely, if God is all-knowing, then he knows what the problem is. If he's all-loving, he wants to help us because he doesn't want us to suffer. And if he's all-powerful, he can do it. Surely, God can't exist. I mean, you'll be surprised to know that as a vicar, I'm going to argue that he does. But it is complex. It is complex. Like I said, I think to get a grip on this, we do have to understand different types of evil, so moral evil and natural evil. And I think actually for me, the moral evil side of things is a bit easier to understand. I say a bit, it's still remarkably complex. But I think there's a reason how a God of love can allow evil and suffering. And over the course of this week, I've been coming up with a flowchart, a circular flowchart. Sorry if this is a bit too much like a seminar, but this is the best way that I've found to explain it to myself, and I hope it will be helpful to you. So, Roger, if we can have my circular flowchart up on the screen. And here we go. I start with the fact that God is love. That's the basis of all my theology. And that's the basis of my theology because I read it in the Bible, that's my understanding, because it's my lived experience, and because my logic and my rationale lead me to believe that. So God is love. It's not just that he's quite loving or very loving, he is love. And in fact, all his other attributes, so he is wise, he is just, etc., etc., those are part of his love. God and love are inseparable from one another. God is love. The second thing that I believe is that love cannot be controlling. Love cannot be controlling. Now, sadly, in our human relationships, we all too often see a muddle and a mess between love and control. But when it comes down to it, if there is control in a relationship, that is to say, if one person makes all the choices and the other person doesn't have any choices whatsoever, that's not love. It's abuse. So love cannot be controlling. So as then I work through those two things, God is love and love cannot be controlling. I therefore believe that God does not seek to control us, because that would mean that it wasn't a loving relationship. We therefore have free will to make our choices, because we have that free will. That gives us the opportunity to make good choices and bad choices. We have to have that opportunity, because otherwise we would be being controlled. But of course, what it does mean is that sometimes we make bad choices. By we here, I'm talking about kind of humanity through the ages. Sometimes we make bad choices, and sometimes those bad choices lead to evil and suffering. And so this is the point where we might say, well, come on, God, if there's evil and suffering, step in and do something about it. But God can't intervene on every single occasion, because if he does, he would be controlling. And God can't be controlling because he is love. And we're back to the beginning. Now, I don't know if that makes as much sense to you as it does to me. But for me, what it says is this. Whereas we often want to ask the question, if God is love, how can there be evil and suffering? I think we have to flip it on its head. There is evil and suffering because God is love. And whilst that sounds completely topsy-turvy and upside down, the alternative is so much worse. Because the only other alternative is for God to be abusive and controlling instead of loving. So, I think, for me, that gives me at least some answers towards why evil and suffering exist in terms of moral evil and suffering. It's because God is love and we have a free will to make our choices. The problem with natural evil, earthquakes, floods, viruses, volcanoes, is a bit more complex, I think. There's a couple of caveats I want to say at the start here, and that is that actually we don't know how much natural evil is caused or exacerbated by moral evil. The things that we do in this world as humanity have an enormous impact upon the natural world. So, for example, the awful earthquakes in Syria and Turkey just recently. It's a natural disaster. But so much of the devastation and the loss of life was caused by moral evil, by selfish, greedy people lining their own pockets and building insubstantial and insufficient tower blocks. In another way, at the moment there are floods all around the world in places like Bangladesh and other low-lying countries. And those floods are caused by rising oceans. And those rising oceans are caused, are caused by melting ice caps, and those melting ice caps are caused by climate change, which in turn is caused by us, the choices that we have made. So you see, some natural evil is not easily distinguishable from moral evil. But nonetheless, there comes a point, I think, where we say there is natural evil. There are things that happen which cause suffering, loss, and death. And I've got to say, I don't have a brilliant explanation for why that is the case. What I do at that point is choose to put my trust in God. Now, for some of you, as I say that, you'll think, that sounds great, that's right. And some of you will think, well, hang on, isn't that a bit of a cop-out? So I'm going to keep wrestling with this stuff, keep trying to work it out. But there comes a point where we have to just trust in God. We have to acknowledge that he is love and that he sees the beginning from the end, which I don't. And so I choose to put my trust in God. And perhaps why I do that will become clear as we move to the second part of the talk today, which is response. Both our response to suffering and also God's response to suffering. And it's because of some of those things that I choose to put my trust in God. There's a brilliant book in the Bible called Job. Some of you may have read it. It's in the Old Testament, and it's a parable. It's a story about a man who had everything. Lovely wife, amazing children who passed all their A-levels and never did drugs and all that kind of stuff. And he had loads of money, all the camels and cattle you could hope for in life. And then it's all taken away. It all goes. All his family die. All his wealth is taken away, and he is left with nothing. He suffers in pretty much every way that a human can suffer. And the story of Job is about Job desperately and only just clinging on to his faith. And it's made much harder by the fact he has some rubbish friends. And his friends sit with him, and one after the other, they basically preach at him, giving a load of monologues about why he's suffering and what he should do about it. And so there's some unhelpful responses to suffering that we can draw on here. So the first is, they blame him for his suffering. They say to him, well, it must be because you've sinned. You must be a really awful sinner, and that's why you're suffering. Sadly, victim blaming is all too common. Not just for Job, but throughout history. I'm sure you remember the awful devastation caused by the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. You might also remember the despicable word spoken by a famous American televangelist, pronouncing to the world that it was because of the Haitians' sins that God had chosen to punish them all. It was disgraceful and despicable. But it is all too common. And of course, even in our own lives sometimes, we can blame ourselves. Now, I need to be clear here. There are things which we do which have the natural consequences of bad things happening to us. Right? If I get angry and punch a wall, I'm going to hurt my hand. And I'm going to hurt the wall more because I'm very strong and very manly. But I'm going to hurt my hand. So there are, of course, things which we do in our own lives which lead to that. But the Bible is clear, and Jesus is really clear, that that's not the primary reason why evil and suffering occur. There's not a direct link between my sin and my suffering, or your sin and your suffering. So Jesus, in Matthew 13, referring to an accident that had happened, an awful disaster in the city, says, and what about those 18 people who died when the Tower of Siloam fell upon them? Were they more sinful than all the others in Jerusalem? No. So victim blaming in others or in ourselves is not an appropriate response. But we should look to the way that we're living and seek to make sure that we are being godly and holy in how we live. The second thing, or one of the other things that the friends of Job say to him is, don't worry, mate, everything happens for a reason. God's got a plan. I'm just going to say it. When someone else is suffering, don't ever say to them, God's got a plan. It's the most horrible thing to hear when you're in the middle of suffering something awful. Now, my life has been pretty good and pretty easy. But I suppose one way in which I've suffered, although probably less than people might think, is with my eyesight. If I'm feeling low about my blindness, don't tell me that God's got a plan. Because at that moment, I'm going to say to you, well, why hasn't he got a better plan? Why hasn't he got a plan where I can see my children and where I can see my wife, who is apparently even more beautiful than she was 15 years ago? I mean, it's mainly Tours who's telling me that. But at that moment, that's not what I want to hear. I believe God has a plan. I believe he sees the beginning from the end. But when we say to someone who's in the midst of suffering, God has a plan, it makes it sound like God has planned for exactly this, and he's pretty chuffed that you're suffering right now. But that's not it. Like I said, we have free will. We make choices. I don't believe that everything happens for a reason. But what I do believe is that God is working for the good. He is continually drawing us to himself. He is continually redeeming us and the whole of the universe. We're working towards that point. You know, in a few minutes' time, we're going to be singing a song, Sovereign Over Us. And in the chorus of that song, it says, your plans are still to prosper. But it doesn't begin there. It begins by saying, there is strength within the sorrow, there is beauty in our tears, and you meet us in our mourning with a love that casts out fears. The place where God begins with us is not that he has a plan, but rather that he meets us in our mourning. God is present with us in our mourning. And I know that when we're suffering and when things are hard, sometimes it's almost impossible to recognize that. I know that for myself. And yet what I believe is that God meets me in my mourning. And in fact, in the book of Job, that's what God does with Job. He doesn't follow the same route that Job's annoying friends do. Instead, he sits with Job. He engages with him. He meets with him. And you know, I think that's our calling too with others who are suffering. Don't go in with platitudes. Don't go in with, God's got a plan. That might come later. Meet people in their mourning. Sit with them. Weep with them. Pray with them. So God met Job in his mourning. He also met him in the mystery. So towards the end of Job, there's a few chapters which are all about God explaining to Job that there's quite a lot that Job doesn't know. There's quite a lot that is a mystery. But it's not a mystery to God. God created the universe. He created the hills and the valleys and the stars and the sand and the sky and the earth and the eggs and the chickens and everything else. God meets us in the mystery. It is okay for us not to have the answers to some of these difficult questions, because life is a mystery. If it wasn't, we'd be God. But God meets us in that mystery, and we can trust him to do that. So God meets us in our mourning. He meets us in the mystery. And then perhaps most profoundly of all, God suffers with us. The book of Job, as with so much of the Old Testament, points forward towards Christ. Towards Christ, who amongst so many other things was the man of sorrows, the man of suffering. God knows what it is to suffer. And that's the most extraordinary truth that the Christian faith has to offer. It's not just that God says, well, it's a bit of a mystery, hard luck. He engages in the suffering with us and for us. And so, of course, this is where we get to the reading that Mabu read, I don't know, several hours ago now. It's a bit disconcerting, isn't it, that basically everything up till now has just been the introduction to the passage. Don't panic. We're nearly done. God suffers in Christ with us, and he suffers for us. Because part of the mystery is that although we still suffer now, although we experience the results of evil, Jesus has taken that evil upon himself. That is the truth, that is the promise of Good Friday. God suffers with us, and he suffers for us. But the story doesn't end with Good Friday, does it? The story continues to Easter Sunday. We are Good Friday people with a God who suffers with us, but we are also Easter Sunday people with a God who rises from the dead and who offers new life and new hope. The God who is with us in the darkness of the pit is also the light at the end of the tunnel. So God meets us in the mourning, in our mourning. He meets us in the mystery. He suffers with us and for us. But he also offers us hope pointing towards better things to come. And so, I know there's been a lot today, and some of it's been quite intellectual, and some of it may be a bit more personal. And depending on where you are in your life and what's going on for you at the moment, there'll be different things that it might be helpful for you to take from the sermon today. It might be that there'll be something intellectual about that problem of evil and how we can rationalize to some degree why evil exists. It might be an acknowledgement that at some point we have to just trust, have to put our trust in God. It might be to recognize now that God meets you in your mourning and in the mystery, that he suffers with you. Or it might be a tiny moment of hope. And so I conclude with something that Jeanette, our wonderful parish administrator here, told me this week. She said that she really struggles with Good Friday, with the suffering and the sorrow and the sadness. And last year, feeling all of that, she went out for a walk. She was walking through the woods. And as she walked, she began to notice that the trees that had been bare were coming into leaf. That there were small patches of pink and white blossom on the ground. And then as she entered perhaps the darkest, most shady part of the wood, suddenly in front of her was a tiny, yet beautiful, bright yellow butterfly. God is with us in the darkness, but he is also the butterfly, our hope, our new life, as we live resurrected lives with him. Amen.